Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
And we're joined today by Chris Harris, who is out with a brand new book for children, I'm Just No Good at Rhyming. The book is available now wherever you find books are sold, many different places, Amazon.com and what as one. Chris, you've got an extensive writing career for different television shows. What prompted you, as so many authors have done now, to get into the writing of a children's book?
Well, yeah, I love what is now my day job of TV writing. As a friend pointed out, there are no shortage of TV executives who've at some point or another told me my writing seems immature. But it was really having my own kids that made me want to write something just for them. And that's how this book started out. It was a collection of the funny poems and paradoxes and other things that I got to make them laugh over the years. So it started out as a personal thing and me just trying to connect with my own kids more.
Were some of these poems that you'd come up with your own kids just through time and decided to write down?
Yes, that's exactly right. I'm sorry, can you repeat that, Brian? I missed the first half.
Were these poems that you have in the book, are these something that you had said over the years to your kids and you got the beat down to them and you just decided to write them down for the first time?
Yes, exactly. As my kids grew up and we started to have these running jokes among each other, and some of them were, some of them were little in jokes to us. Like any time someone tried to read The Old Woman Who Lived in a Shoe, when they got to the point that someone says a shoe, one of us would yell "Bless you" and mess up the whole thing because a shoe and a chew obviously are sound alike. And then there are other things that are. Some of the poems came about from real incidents. For example, when my daughter Josie was about three, we were, it was some ridiculously early morning, and I was trying to get her to eat her eggs, and I resorted to that cliche that parents use, eat your breakfast. It's the most important meal of the day. And without skipping a beat, she just looked up at me and said, "Well, that's not very nice to lunch." And so that became a poem because it cracked me up, the idea of what does lunch think about breakfast being the most important meal, and that became a poem. I believe the title is "Just Because I'm a Turkey Sandwich and Some Chips Doesn't Mean I Don't Have Feelings Too," not to be confused with a poem of the same title by Lord Byron.
Right.
So it's a mixture of funny ideas that made us laugh. Oh, here's the what if there was an island where everyone had the same name, Toby, and then things that happened to us that we laughed at. Over the years.
Well, one of the ones that made me laugh out loud, because it did remind me of a situation I had when I was growing up, was that I would assume one of your kids said to you that why should you make your bed? It just gets messed up again. And then mom threw away her breakfast and said, "Well, you don't need breakfast because you'll just get hungry again." That's kind of what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's been one, I've read that a few times in crowds, and there are some that kids laugh at more, and there are some that you can hear the parents laughing at more. And that one, it's crickets with the kids, but boy, the parents really jump all over that. Let me see. Some of my titles get a little long. That one is called "The Last Time I Ever Went Down to Breakfast Without Making My Bed."
Well, some of these would make great short stories. And what made you decide to go with the poetry route? Because I think it really works well, even though these would make good little bits for maybe a 5 or 6 page story.
Well, thank you. Part of it was necessity. When I started these, my kids, at least one of them, and I won't say Silas's name, wasn't sleeping through the night. And so I didn't really have all my brain cells working at full capacity, and I actually tried to write a. It's funny you mentioned that. I did try to write a start a novel for them, and I just could not keep anything in my head. So with that one not working, short form poetry seemed like just the right thing for my brain capacity. I'll also say that poems and humorous poems, I have such a fond place in my heart for them when I was growing up, and I think there is something about them that kids respond to. I think maybe it's the rhythm you can anticipate, oh, here's where the twist is coming. I wonder what the joke is going to be. And as I'm going through this and I'm seeing the response, which I'm blown away by with this book, I'm wondering if that's part of what is appealing to kids about it, the fact that there's something in the rhythm and the rhyming that lets them jump ahead and see if they're right. So I stumbled on it, but I'm happy I did too.
And your audience for this book, who did you have in mind when you wrote? Was it your own kids? Was it children that would read it? Was it adults? Who would you think about?
I officially I wrote it for my own kids, but the truth is that a lot of things were also things that made me laugh, and maybe that's where the subtitle, Other Nonsense for Mischievous Kids and Immature Grown-Ups, comes in. I grew up with a lot of my favorite things were always the books and movies that and comedy that made me sit up and go, oh my gosh, I didn't know you could do that. That's amazing. Things like obviously Shel Silverstein, but also Phantom Tollbooth and Lewis Carroll and of course when I got older, Monty Python and David Letterman who I was lucky to work for. And all of those things were acts and books and stories that played with the form. And so I really had a lot of fun playing with the form of both the poems and, once it became a book, the book itself. We started to, as my kids got older, they started helping me out, and we thought, oh, every poetry book has an index. What if we have an outdex of all the poems that weren't good enough to make it into the book? And what if the illustrator and the writer start actually don't really like each other that much throughout the book? And we all had a lot of fun playing with the form and figuring out what else we could do. What I also love about the book is, because I wrote this over the years for my kids, there is a pretty broad age range. Some of them are things that a parent could read to a child, and some of them are things that, my sixth grade daughter is only now starting to say, oh, okay, I totally get what you're doing here. I loved those books that you could sort of come back to one year after another and find different things to love about it. So hopefully that's something that today's children, a few of them might do with this book.
Well, and you mentioned your time working for David Letterman, and I think you were with Letterman, it was about 20 years ago you started with him, right?
That's correct, yes.
Okay, so as you're writing, how many writers are there on a particular show like The Late Show?
At any given time, they're probably around 12 to 14 writers, especially on a existing show. If it's a new show, then sometimes the staff is a little bit smaller. But yeah, I started in 1998, and at the time, it had still been going on for a long time, and that was a big moment walking into that room for the first time, and I felt the pressure. That was my first TV job, and walking in there and saying, "Wow, I'm part of a long lineup of pretty incredible writers who've gotten their start working for this brilliant man."
So, were you writing top 10 lists, monologue jokes, everything?
I did. The very first day, the surprising thing as a coming in was I wasn't prepared for the fact that, oh, well, this is a job. I thought, oh, I'm going to be a writer for Letterman. We're all going to be shooting Nerf guns at each other all the time. And no, of course, we have there's a show to put on every evening. So, I got in, we had a meeting, I met everyone, and then the top 10 assignment was passed out. So then I go to my office and then you're writing. And there was no better place to learn there's no better boot camp for writing than there, because that's what you do. You come in, you write for 12 hours, you leave, and you do it again the next day, whether you think that you have any ideas or not. But the very first day, I got 4 out of the 10 top 10 lists on, and I couldn't believe it. The idea that something that I'd written a few hours ago was suddenly coming out of my television set was still one of the most fun moments I've had in 20 years in television.
Did you have to deal with a lot of standards and practice type people? You can't joke about A, B, C because it's too volatile of a topic, those types of things when you're writing there?
Definitely. The interesting thing is since after Letterman, I moved on to half-hour comedies. it's a lot more Wild West on the late night shows, mainly because there's no time for anything. So it's definitely a little looser. And it's funny because it almost becomes a job of ours to see how far we can push the envelope. I think it's Colbert who's been doing a lot of actually pushing the envelope and seeing how far he can, you know, if you turn the picture upside down, then it's one thing, but if you turn it up the other way, then it's something that can't be shown on television. And I think they've been having a lot of fun trying to figure out where the line is, because we never knew. But yes, and that does extend to sitcoms. I mean, the number of conference calls we've had about what you can call this part of one's body and how many times one's allowed to say it within a 3-minute period, it's sometimes you look around and say, oh my, how am I doing this for a living? And you can say that with a laugh, or you can say that and get a little depressed about what you're spending your time arguing about.
Well, and I've got to think at this point, I mean, it's 2017, everybody's got Sirius Radio, they listen to basically R-rated radio. Have you seen the standards of practice loosen up a bit? Because it seems like that's a little prudish for 2017.
Yeah, that's a good question. It's funny. Network television still, I'm talking about, you know, CBS, ABC, NBC, Fox. They still seem to operate in their, I don't want to say bubble, it sounds too negative, but they do seem to operate in their own world and with their own standards. I wouldn't say that there's been a big change, although you're right. You look at what comes out of Sirius XM or what you see on billboards and or what you hear from the politician, and it seems like everywhere else has loosened up. But they so far it seems like there's a pretty strict adherence to standards.
Well, you were on you're writing for How I Met Your Mother and producing there for a long time. On shows like that, and I think you're on The Great Indoors now, right?
That was last year.
Okay.
Yeah. We finished that up.
Okay. But as you sit there and write, especially with a situation comedy, how much rewriting gets done during the filming process that sometimes you don't even recognize some of the lines you wrote by the time they make it to air?
it's a massive amount of rewriting. Like I said, there are around 12 writers on any given show, and every episode has a person who officially wrote it, but really everyone's writing every episode, and it's the showrunner's job to guide the train. And so you come up with the idea in the room, and then you write an outline with people, and then you write a first draft, get notes, a second draft, you get notes, the studio weighs in, the network weighs in, standards and practices weighs in. One actor might have an issue, a director. It is there are a million hoops to jump through, and that's one of the challenges, especially when you're running a new show. Back when, by the time we were at season 3 or 4, How I Met Your Mother, we'd become a little bit of a hit, and so we had the right to say, you know, we believe in this idea, we're going to keep going with it. when you're on a new show, you do need to, you know, play ball still, and I think that makes it. I think you're right. It makes it difficult to remember sometimes what was that original idea that made us love this show or this idea in the first place. I'll say that's been one of the just delightful things about having this children's book is that there aren't that, you know, dozens and dozens of layers. You know, what's amazing to me is that what I wrote is what people are seeing, and it's wonderful. It's a little bit terrifying. I mean, because if somebody doesn't like the book, then I can't blame the sound guy and I can't blame the network notes because those are my own words. But it's been a really fun part of writing this book for me is getting my own exact words out there, much as I love writing for television.
As many TV tapings as you've been to, as the writer you're sitting there, I interviewed Bob Perlow a year or two ago. He was a warm-up comedian in Hollywood for about 35 years. It sounds to me like TV taping nights, even though it looks like the audience is having a lot of fun, has to be the most awful process to sit through for 8 or 9 hours. You get hungry, tired, got to go to the bathroom. Is that kind of how it is if you're not working?
Yes, if you're doing it for 8 or 9 hours, then absolutely it is an awful process. And we always tried to, I think you lose the audience after about 3 or 4 hours, and who can blame them? Sometimes, depending on the show, you lose them a lot faster. It is a it can be a grueling process. It's also, though, when it works, it's incredible, because there's nothing more showbiz in a good way about a TV taping, because, you know, it's like performing a play for a bunch of people. If you have to do 18 takes of something, then no, there's no worse place to be. So we always try, on the shows I'm on, we always try to go fast, and if we don't quite have something, we'll keep going forward anyway, and maybe there's a chance to tape it again once the audience has left, or the next week before the audience gets in, because they're giving us their time. You know, they're coming in expecting a show, and if they're sitting there for 9 hours, I don't care how many sandwiches or pieces of candy you throw at them. To me, we're not doing our job of being entertaining for these people.
All right. Well, Chris Harris, you've done so much, and now you're out with this new children's book. It's just fantastic. I'm Just No Good at Rhyming by Chris Harris. The book's available now in several different formats, wherever your books are sold. Check it out on Amazon and other places. Chris, thanks so much for writing a great book for adults and children to like and enjoy, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. I hope people check it out. I really appreciate it. Thanks, sir.
Thanks,
Brian.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakalskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.
The name game. Shirley, 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 Bo Burley, Bonana, Fana, Bo Furley, Fee, Fi, Mo Merrily. Shirley.